Talking again with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for our Friday Tacky Talk. Nice to see you, Tacky.
Good to see you, Joe. Didn't see you exactly on that Tuesday. I got Mark instead, so that was a nice change.
Yeah, it was good to have you. Appreciate that. I should start by congratulating you. I know you were not opposed, but nevertheless, you got, I think, over 77% of the vote in your district, so congratulations.
Oh, you know more than I do because I can't find the numbers online.
I will send them to you.
I had not want to bother Nikki. I know they're processing late ballots and mail-in ballots, and that she had warned me that she'd be quite busy. So I did not want to bother the clerk about my numbers. I figured I can wait to next week.
Today is the last day that the mail-in ballots postmarked by November 3rd can be accepted. So those will be tabulated as well.
Yeah, and then we'll get the official number. But thank you very much, and glad that we have a chance to continue to serve the people. I mean, myself and my staff, we do our best, respond to constituents, and I do listen to people's different policy positions. At the same time, managing issues on the committee chair level, working on different policy issues with my colleagues. I want to try and make my best to, while we suffer COVID year now, do my best to be accessible in public on the different events throughout my district and throughout the city. But also working on Asian American issues, big surprise, with the Asian Caucus, and now working at the National Conference State Legislators Caucus on Asian American issues. And, also dealing with consulates, people forget. I deal a lot with foreign consulates, including the Koreans, the Japanese. Actually, the German consulate has become my friend the last several years on learning about issues in Germany. It's a pretty involved gig. And I think people don't realize exactly the broad scope of things I do, from continuing to maintain the relations with our allies overseas, from making sure I try to get to the local events. Normally today would be the House Neck Church Fair, which unfortunately, as we know, the COVID restrictions keep any kind of major event happening. So.
Now, were you not one of the first Asian Americans elected to the State House?
Yes, it was myself and Donald Wong from Saugus, and then Paul Schmidt later found out was part Chinese. He's like one quarter Chinese on his mother's side. So, three in the house, which is quite remarkable, because I remember the conversation towards the end of my campaign and people wondering if any Asian Americans were ever elected to the house. And there, people assume that we have been, given the, once again, given how little people know about Asian Americans in state politics. But also these kind of like misconceptions often, they had to have been one. Well, they hadn't been until 2010. And if I got to check my calendar, but this is my 10th year anniversary of election. The Quincy Sun got a little bit of an error regarding my terms of office, but this would be my officially 10 years this month. So I got to dig out one of the old pictures and post it on Facebook today and tomorrow.
Yeah, and I would bet that you look the same.
You can take a look at my Facebook this weekend, and we can discuss next week about my aging process.
Sounds good. Speaking of elections, Tacky, what do you think? What are your reflections of what's going on in the country right now?
Well, I'm a political junkie. Big surprise, right? I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't love and obsess over it. And, it's become, I call it like the NCAA, a Turner and Brackett, these little electoral maps. I'm sitting around just playing with maps, trying to map out what could potentially happen based on polling data. And the polls, again, were challenged in most places because the turnout was so enormous. I mean, it's the highest turnout we've ever seen. I've not seen exact Quincy numbers, but the Quincy Sun says it's in the 70% zone. I think it's even higher than I expected, well over 70%. And nationally, it seems to be trending that way. I mean, 100 and almost 130 men closing in, like 125 men, but it'd be probably up with that when all the ballots are counted. Never seen a turnout that high in raw numbers. And clearly, both candidates, the president and challenger Joe Biden, pulled out massive votes together. And just like 4 years ago, Joe Biden clearly has the popular vote lead, and now we're just waiting electoral votes. And certain states, I did not give the Democrats any credit of winning, such as Georgia, this morning, this is Friday morning, has taken the lead. And it's a small margin. It's in the recount zone. If you're 0.5% differential, you can get a recount. But the challenger of the recount has to pay for the recount. Hmm. So there's that financial cost of recounts. But there's, you know, they just saw the news, maybe 9,000-ish ballots in the end on overseas, and maybe 6,000-ish ballots on absentee that's still counting. So it can obviously change really fast, but, you know, Joe Biden has been overperforming immensely. And in Pennsylvania, if you look at the data from some of the voting rights organizations, because certain Secretary of State will release party affiliation data, meaning what party registration took on a ballot, the Biden campaign was able to get 1.5 million registered Democrats to take out ballots by absentee in Pennsylvania. The Republican Party barely cracked 500,000, I think it was like 530-ish, and unenrolled persons took over 230,000. So there's a lot of talk about Biden closing the almost 600,000, 550,000 vote gap from election night to now, and they're still counting. And it appears that Democrats who are registered Democrats are voting Democrat. I tell people, just because you're registered doesn't mean it's guaranteed you're going to vote for the party you're registered in.
Oh, that's right.
No guarantee.
No, it's not like a primary. That's right. Yeah.
That's correct. So it appears that Democrats are falling through in Pennsylvania. And as this now, 20 votes in Pennsylvania guarantees a Biden win. So Arizona is the other place I had actually given to Biden. And I've been telling all my friends all week, I gave that on to Biden early on. People ask why. Well, demographic shifts in places like Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and Arizona, there's people from California moving for cheaper property and to retire. And if you don't want to go to Florida humidity, dry desert heat is not a bad choice if you're a person that needs that type of environment to stay comfortable. And the cost of living is very low in those areas. Property is cheap. And as a result, the state and the county government has to adjust the infrastructure for a different population. And also COVID-19 has severely hit older populations, as we all know. And in fact, Nevada and Arizona has a very fast growing older population. COVID-19 is forefront on their mind. And given the administration's response, the record breaking death rate in the state and in the country, and the fact that we continue to lead the world on infections and deaths related to COVID-19 is not far off on people's mind, particularly if you're a vulnerable population.
Yeah, I couldn't help but wonder if this, you know, whole election would have a different look had there not been a pandemic.
I agree. I had Donald Trump winning last summer for one simple reason. The economy was strong. The U.S.-China trade war, which you're happy, I'm happy to talk about that, U.S.-China trade war, which we're watching very carefully, as well as NAFTA and his fight with everyone overseas in Europe on tariffs. And the impact it's had, it has had negative impact on certain industries. I talked a little bit about the fact we have aluminum shortage. Beer cans could be a problem at some point if the trade war doesn't change. So if you like your beer, well, guess what? It might be hitting your pocketbook sometime. The beer companies are trying not to increase prices on people. But everything, you know, right down to the price of vanilla has been impacted. So, you know, some of the stuff has hit your pocketbook. Some of it's not. Tariffs are paid by us, not by foreign governments, because they just pass the cost along like everything else. But despite that, low unemployment rates, cost of living may have risen, but your paychecks have risen a little bit at a time, some by law, like minimum wage law, some by the fact there's more money to go around. And people were feeling pretty good about their financial stability overall in this country. But COVID brought that to a stop, and how you respond to crises is what makes or break a leader. Whether it be something like a sports game or it running a country, we've seen it time and time again. So, you know, not to use a sports analogy to trivialize this, but I mean, watching Tom Brady when he was still here march down the field to win games, to get to the, you know, get to field goal range or get that touchdown pass, or pass it off to the, you know, runner to get it in, is a sign of leadership. Same thing on a national level. 9/11, I know I'm a Democrat, but 9/11, George W. Bush had some hard choices to make that everybody was not happy with, but we were under attack. You know, that's what makes a leader.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. What do you think about the claims of, you know, voter impropriety, voter fraud, ballot impropriety that the president is portraying?
I think they're completely false. I do admit there's always a chance for some errors. Any city clerk will tell you there are some small errors here and there, but nothing that's catastrophic or not remedied. The reality is that we don't have hanging chads anymore. People remember 2000. I remember vividly the 2000 election on the hanging chads. And we had that here with Bill Delahunt and Phil Johnson on hanging chads.
Oh, right. I forgot about that. That's right. Yes.
In that primary, where the Supreme Judicial Court ruled for Delahunt after Johnson won two recounts.
Yep.
So Scantron machines make it much more accurate. You have to get within a handful of votes, maybe less than five or even two, to get a recount that may change the situation. You know, they have to verify against the fact you didn't vote before. And this is absentee balloting in most of the states. There are only a small number of states that mail everyone a ballot. Nevada mails everyone a ballot. California, Utah, not all states do this. You had to apply for one, get one, and return it. So, well, like myself and many people have done this, you're just doing extended absentee balloting because of the nature of the state constitution. And that's another verification process. And if you don't have faith and trust in your city clerk, whether it be elected in a town, somewhere elected, or appointed by your city council, well, you don't have faith in them, then go bring up your city council and you're accusing your city government of improprietary behavior or incompetency. Let's think about that. I mean, you're going to start claiming fraud. You're not talking about people out there that are just committing fraud. That you're also accusing the government can't catch the fraud. And there's some incompetence at our level. So I'll be very careful people start running around saying, oh, you know, it was cheated, it was robbed. You're implying that that our government is incapable of doing that. And we're talking about municipal government in Massachusetts. So if you're going to go out and say that, I'd be more than happy to watch you not attack a candidate, but go down, see Nikki and the mayor and city council and say, hey, I think you guys are bad job.
Do you think that this is going to end up in the Supreme Court, like the president said?
No. The Supreme Court historically does not get into this issue. There are very rare occasions, like we saw in 2000, but generally they're very specific, direct circumstances. For the president to want to bring this up, he has to go through the recount process, he has to find it proprietary, he has to find that the recount numbers are not correct, and most importantly, the process by which the counts were done was a violation of state, violation of federal law. Mm-hmm. Federal government, it is a federal crime to tamper federal elections. No surprise, right? It is also we have state crimes to tamper on all elections. Mm-hmm. So if they're going to do that, they have to demonstrate that somehow the counting process violated federal law, which means the Federal Civil Rights Act, which is also the Voting Rights Act, as well as the criminal laws associated and the, you know, compliance issues, because after 2000, they had updated the laws of both the state and federal level to ensure that we wouldn't have a court Bush situation again. So legal teams can't just say fraud, because there's no evidence. They need that and show that the government itself has not followed the law.
Okay. All right. Stay tuned. I think folks are just really glued to their televisions waiting to see what the outcome is going to be.
Well, it's a funny experience because we all know, I mean, if you've been paying any attention to news, I mean, we all know that there's millions of ballots being sent in by Dropbox, by mail-in, by people dropping them off at polling places. And there's overseas military ballots. People always forget about that. I mean, the military has more time in particular to get those ballots mailed in. I'm sure the post office prioritizes military ballots. Even International Space Station, I discovered they found a way to have the one American astronaut to vote from space through an encrypted, secure system back to his home county in Texas. So, you know, clearly, I mean, we always will try to find a way to ensure people are able to vote as opposed to taking away their ability to vote. Well, actually, I should be careful about that because there's some ballot initiatives in places like Florida to give felons the right to vote after they lost. Mm. We do that in Massachusetts. So I got to be careful how I frame my statements. Mm-hmm. So you know, but generally, you know, we want to ensure that if you are eligible to vote, we want to be able to get you to vote. We want to be able to able for you to cast your vote unhindered. And that's a key groundstone of our democracy. And you know, if this was a country that had a federally run electoral system, as I talked about last time, like Belarus, you know, the president in that country can fix the election. Venezuela, another country, can fix the elections federally run. Welcome to federalism. We're called the United States of America. And the states run the elections. The founding fathers left that power in the hands of the state. So the president can make all kinds of accusations, but he doesn't run the elections. And imagine what it'd be like given the current rhetoric coming from the president if we were a Belarus or Venezuela. Yeah, the election would be over. Millions of ballots would not have been counted. And it's very disturbing to give that thought. So I give the founding fathers a lot of credit in the Constitution. And I repeat again that I'm very, a lot of faith in our Constitution and our institutional systems created by the constitutions, the state and federal constitution, to ensure that people's rights aren't trampled on. And state rights is one way to do that.
Sure. Let's talk about a couple of local issues. A new state budget that is being poured over now.
Yeah, yesterday the House Committee on Ways and Means released their FY21 budget recommendations. Given the fact that we don't have a lot of time, we're trying to get this done before the end of the month is our attempt, both House and Senate. And given the fact we're using phone-based Microsoft networks, secure system for debate, amendments are actually due today at 8 p.m. We do recognize that there is not a lot of room in the budget for extra spending from my amendments, but we did have to make some extra spending on COVID. So not to make people dizzy on numbers, but we'll go really quick. We finally settled on a number smaller than I've been talking about on a deficit. House Ways and Means has settled on $3.214 billion revenue loss. That's a 6.8% reduction. So it was smaller than my projection of 3.5 or 3.7 based on the last Ways and Means forecast hearing for economists. The reality is that a portion that goes to the pension fund liability as well as the MBTA school building assistance program, which are dedicated funding off the books, where the legislature doesn't change those amounts. So as a result, $22.408 billion is what we got to spend on tax revenue. So 27.5 is approximately taxes collected we're expecting, which is a 6.8 reduction from last time. And the 22 billion of that is going to be able for us to spend. We are maintaining our commitment prior to the budget process of local aid, the Chapter 70 education funding level fund from last year with adjustment for inflation. Right. We cannot implement education reform funding yet. As you saw, the numbers are pretty big. On the loss, so we're not going to go there just yet. But we are intending to do that at some point once we get out of COVID and we start stabilizing everything around us, which I'm just kind of like, I don't know when that's going to happen, but we got to get ourselves to a level of stability. So you're wondering, how do we close the budget gap? Well, obviously, we have the rainy day fund. It's $3.5 billion. We're not going to spend all of it. We're going to spend $1.55 billion, which leaves us, you know, a substantial remaining in the account. We're doing a capital gains offset. So most people don't realize our capital gains is not going to the budget. It goes to the stabilization fund, the rainy day fund. All capital gains goes to the rainy day fund. So that's always been off budget in terms of the total budget we can spend.
Okay.
So when we do the budget total taxes, a portion, you know, the capital gains component is not part of our general spending.
Okay.
So we're going to divert, big surprise, from FY20. $422 million that was supposed to go to capital gains, send that into the FY21 budget.
Well, so in addition to the stabilization, it's a rainy day.
Well, it is a rainy day. So in addition to the stabilization money that we're going to take out, the rainy day money of $1.5 billion, we're going to take the $422 million that was supposed to go to the rainy day fund and dedicate to FY21.
Okay.
So that's how we're going to close, you know, $2 billion of the gap. Then we got some Corona relief money. We still have our CARES Money Act that's still left with $550 million remaining. We're going to put that into the budget dedicated towards COVID-19 situations. And then we have Medicare funds. Because it's a public health emergency, we are getting more Medicare, Medicaid money, which you all know as MassHealth. That's $834 million. We're going to do an accelerated tax system for sales tax remittance. Normally, it's the 20th day of the next month. We're going to require monthly reporting for the sales tax for $267 million. We're going to do this one time. And all these are all one-time things for FY21, so don't expect this as options for FY22.
Okay.
We're also going to do a one-year delay on the charitable deduction. So if you have a charitable deduction ability in Massachusetts with a cap, we want to do $60 million in that recovery as part of that. So we actually are consistent in our past withdrawals of the rainy day fund. Mostly we keep under 50% withdrawal in the first part of a bad fiscal cycle. Fiscal cycles are never bad. 1 year, it's generally 1 to 3, sometimes 5. 2008 fiscal crisis lasted basically 5 years. Some interesting things about this budget is the COVID response. So we did have to increase funding for a lot of areas. Our budget is slightly bigger than the governor's budget as a result. So we have $50 million dedicated to COVID support for students, especially low-income schools. Quincy had received some money earlier this pre-opening of schools during the summertime to address that. The RAF program, we talk about the eviction issue. This is a major concern for all of us. We're going to have $150 million for RAF money. RAF is the money that provides financial assistance to pay rent. We're adding 50 more. We're going to bump ours up by $50 million, well over the governor's increased recommendation of $60 million. And we're also creating a provision where if your application is in a RAF program and it's pending approval, you cannot be evicted until the results of that application. If it's approved, the landlord's getting his or her money. Mm-hmm. If it's not approved, obviously eviction process can begin. So having $150 million dedicated to that will be very helpful. Food security is an issue. I've talked about that all summer long. Food banks are having issues. We're not expecting any additional assistance in SNAP programs at the moment than what we're getting from the feds. So we're going to put $43 million into basically food security on the state level. Governor recommended 25, we're recommending $43 million. Substance abuse is another issue that we're having concerns with COVID. We're trapped in our homes. I'll be honest, I'm depressed. I've talked about this before. This roller coaster wave of COVID impact on us. So it's about $147 million the governor recommended. We're going to make it 161.
Okay.
And other spending increases as a result of COVID is domestic violence. Governor recommended $39.8 million. We're going to recommend $45.8 million. We're going to increase the domestic violence abuse programs. Illegal assistance is another place we have to provide for, particularly people who are indigent, don't have the ability to get pay for lawyers themselves. We have Greater Boston Legal Service to service our area. Governor recommended $24 million. We're recommending $29 million. And we haven't forgot about the disability community. DSS has been very much impacted. Group homes, workforce programs, education programs, turning 22 programs have all been impacted disability community. So we're going to give an increase there from $219 million to $264 million. So the governor's recommended $219 million, we're recommending $264 million. All our local aid issues, put in perspective, people think the budget has all kinds of flexibility. Chapter 70 alone, education money is $5.2 billion. And local aid, which is basically free money to the city of Quincy and our cities and towns, is $1.1 billion. So, $6.3-ish billion is committed to cities and towns. When you throw in special education, charter school reimbursement, transportation, homeless assistance for kids, kids that are high risk, yep. Dedicated money to try to help them out. And then we add the $50 million in support funding. City and towns are going to get at least $7 billion. Okay, now remind you, tax revenue was $27 billion. We had taken out a chunk of that for a dedicated cost and off budget, so we don't have $22 billion to spend. All of that $7 billion is going to cities and towns.
Okay.
So give me an idea.
How about the homeless shelter? Sorry, how about the MBTA?
The MBTA, we've done a couple. I don't have the exact MBTA number coming in because it's tied directly to sales tax, but we did something interesting for them. In the closeout number for yesterday, we did a session yesterday to close out the books for FY20. Mm-hmm. But allowed the MBTA to use bond money to pay for staff. the state moving and discouraging using bond money to pay for day-to-day payroll because it costs us more money for you to do that because you have to pay the interest on the loans mm-hmm. than just regular payroll. But given the financial crisis, the low ridership of the T, and no federal assistance for transportation issues, we're going to have to get creative for at least one fiscal cycle to allow the MBTA to put P1 payroll onto bond, meaning they have to tie to a bond project. So if you're like an engineer working on a capital project, you can move that engineer onto the bond money.
Okay.
As a full-time employee. Again, this is not a practice we encourage, but given the financial crisis, this is trying to save jobs that are essential to keep the T functional. And as you've all seen, there's a massive amount of capital projects that have already started prior to the T that we cannot stop in the middle.
Right.
But that's kind of a short-term fix, but we don't have a long-term solution yet into ridership returns, which again is tied to the COVID-19 situation.
Right. Yeah, well, as everything is really, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I have to tell anybody, people are nervous getting on the T. I mean, that's how it is.
What do you think about the new restrictions that are going into effect today, actually?
Well, I won't lie. I think picking a 9:30 time seemed a little odd. I would have picked an even number, to be honest with you. Mm. I talked to the Secretary of Economic Development Housing staff as it was going to go through this process. And I kind of get it. I mean, if you're past a certain hour, the expectation is not going to be on the streets anyway. Past 10 p.m. on a weekday. Not a lot of people out unless you're going to work on 10 p.m. on weekdays. I mean, really, when you think about it, we're still a family-oriented state for the most part. So that's not surprising. The weekend's going to be tough because people obviously want to be out later at night. But winter is coming, and unfortunately, restaurants are going to have a hard time staying open through the winter months. And the sun's setting close to 5 p.m., much to my depression. I know we know it happens every year, but it doesn't stop the same mentality. We all know this is winter and we all know the sun sets earlier, but for some reason, you still feel bad about it.
I know, it's new every year. I know.
Yeah, I know, it's kind of a weird phenomenon psychologically. You know, it happens every year your whole life, but you still feel weird about it when it happens.
Right.
So, I mean, there's that practical reality too, right? And we didn't want to go here, but this system has been done in Europe. It's been done in New York. Other parts of the world has done similar systems, but unlike other places, we don't have police on the streets to shuffle you back to your house.
Right.
It is an advisory, meaning that we prefer you not to do that, but it can't really stop you. Mask wearing at all times, I think, is smart. I think people have now seen on the streets and in stores, people forget to put the mask on after they put it down. This is very human behavior. I don't fault anybody for it, but I still believe the more you wear it, the easier it is on you.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard this continuation of herd immunity is the only solution. Go look at Sweden. They have the highest percentage death count in Europe because they're trying herd immunity, and their antibody count is very low. You need a herd immunity of 90% minimum to get some level of herd immunity on a disease which has not been proven in a very small number of situations so far, very small number of reinfection. So the science is still out. So mask wearing helps you, and why? It's simple. You keep your germs to yourself. You transmit less germs while you're wearing a mask because you keep those liquid particles that come out of your breath in the mask. Go home and wash your mask or spray it down, please. Because you're breathing into it, you can't transmit those particles. It makes it safe for everyone around you because it's not getting your clothes or your hands, other places may cling to. And obviously, as you get colder, flu season's coming up, and the norovirus, and all the other normal, not fun illnesses we have. So, if you get COVID plus one of the regular ones, so to speak, it just makes it worse.
Yeah, you'd be very sick. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to hurt. It's going to be bad. So mask wearing is a way to keep those droplets to yourself. People like it doesn't work. Yeah, it doesn't stop a virus, but we're not talking about the virus. We're talking about the droplets to carry the virus.
Yeah, slow the spread has been the mantra all through this event, right?
Yeah, and I think people wear the mask more to get used to it. I do understand you wear it. The advisory is to wear it all the time. It makes a lot of sense. And again, I mean, people forget. you pull it down, you kind of forget about it for a second. It's kind of human nature. Mm-hmm. It's people who flauntedly, intentionally, not wearing masks, thinking that you have herd immunity or, you know, it can't happen to you. Well, again, I remind you, if you're one of the people listening, go please visit Boston Medical Center. They're looking for volunteers to help them out. You don't believe it's real. You know, there are people looking for volunteers in hospitals still to help out those rising COVID cases and ICU cases right now.
Yeah.
So you can see for yourself.
As you predicted, Tacky, question one passed, question two did not.
Yep, 75% margin, question one. It's nice when we have a slogan, a right to repair. So I'd like to remind everybody, third-party repair shops still can repair your cards prior to question one and will be able to repair your cards after question one. So where does that leave us? I've talked to several media outlets about this already. The way it works is that when a ballot question is approved, it's treated like a regular law. Once the Secretary of State certifies the question as approved by the voters, which it has, it will go into effect in 90 days. Now, as we talked earlier, all the ballots aren't in yet. The mail-in ballots from overseas aren't in. So the official certification can't occur until after all the ballots have been accepted. So it's not going to affect November 3rd as the start of 90 days. Mm-hmm. It's when those ballots are officially certified. So that's a few more weeks away. So the issue here revolves around wireless and non-wired access to data in your card, who should get it. And is it strictly mechanical data or everything in your card that you do? People think, oh, it's only my card. Well, you have GPS data, that's true. Every time you download your iPhone or your Android phone, your contacts go into a car, and your radio stations, even the weight, because some cars actually measure weight when you get into it. It's really very technology sophisticated. And as I remind folks, if you can get out, you can get in. So data security, if there's a methodology for someone to get into a system by requesting something and data comes out, there's a way to go back the other direction. And hackers do not go into databases and central headquarter buildings. They're looking for basic users getting an email or viruses through other means or access to a vehicle in this instance to try to get into the wireless network to go all the way back to a GM, for example, to its main database and start mining data. Right now it's a closed network. You know, you can hack it. I'm not saying you can't, but it's very difficult to. You have to get to the car, have the right equipment, open it up, and so forth and so forth. But they want to simplify it. So I got to figure out at some point a couple of things. One, are we going to delay implementation of the law? Mm-hmm. Because it's 2022 models. Those who buy new cars, you work in the car industry, knows the 2022 models are on their way now.
Right. Yep.
You know, the models you buy are already being built. So those cars are going to be coming out sometime next year for 2022.
Right.
So now you're going to ask them to change millions and millions of cars or cars dedicated in Massachusetts with this technology we don't even know how it's going to work. So there's that first question, information delay. And the second one is trying to get to the root of the problem. What is the real problem? If the concern is just, I want my mechanical data, that is an alternative form of receiving, such as wireless or Bluetooth, okay, we can just allow for third-party mechanics to be assured they get equal right to that equipment. I believe the current law does that already, but we can always tweak it a little bit to create some more surety. If it's an issue about open access to data, that's a little bit more complicated because there's liability. Mm. So does a third-party repair shop, what's that much liability for accessing open software? Is it going to be the manufacturer's liability? Or is it going to be 100% of the consumer? And if the consumer allows a virus to get into your computer system and you die because someone screws up your car computer through an accident, well, who's responsible for that?
Yeah, they're already talking about, when you buy one of these cars, signing some kind of a consent form, you know, obviously granting access and agreeing to those risks, I'm assuming.
The problem is those risks can result in death or serious injury.
Sure.
That's where it gets really troubling. I don't have an answer for that one yet.
Yep. Stay tuned.
I understand that people vote for it. It's a catchy slogan. I understand why you pay your cars. But now you reach my level of concern regarding these questions and how to protect the public on a safety matter beyond just consumer access or on a commercial level. So,
you know, I mean, look how long it took for recreational marijuana to become implemented, even though it was approved, you know, by voters. So it's not unusual to have a ballot question delayed, I guess.
Yeah. And marijuana, again, you know, I sat on the marijuana committee during that process. And the real big concerns was the fact it didn't comply with any of our substance controlled substance laws. Because even though it's legal, it's still controlled substance. So like alcohol, cigarettes, and so forth. And things like, for example, that one had a simple one. I talked about it on QATV. It was one of the problems. One of the problems that if the store owner of the marijuana shop believes you're over the age of 18, they're not held liable for anything that happens.
That's pretty vague. You can believe that, you know, a 12-year-old is over 18.
That's correct. And all they have to say is they believe it and they held from any liability for any harm created from the product they sell.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fine print, they look, I mean, look, I get it. It's advertising campaign, it's slogans. I mean, I talk about the fact that I actually can't put her out, which is what's real, what's not, because I researched this stuff long enough. But at the end of the day, it's up to legislators' responsibility to protect the interests of the public as well, beyond the ballot question itself. And hopefully I will do some understand what's going on. I'll continue to do some more homework on this issue to try to figure this out. It's very complicated technology issues. I've done a data breach a couple of years back, so I do have some baseline understanding how this works. But hopefully they trust the legislature to find a solution, not because we're defying the voters, but we're trying to protect the voters from potential harm they may not be fully aware of when they voted for a question.
From the people that they supported by voting yes.
I'm actually very concerned with proponents of the question, actually, because they're the ones who benefit from this, and they're the ones who benefit from accessing the data and how much they can get of it. And they pretty much also relieve themselves of any liability in this bill for misuse of your information. So, you know, just to let you know, I think your car repair mechanic's just fine. But, you know, if you have one out there and you don't know who it may be, decides to take away your data and sell it or give it away or give it to a criminal, whose fault is that?
Right.
It's going to be on me, because they, people tend to not blame themselves for a ballot question. They tend to blame the legislature. So I'm not oblivious to the political reality. I've yet to see any person blame themselves for a ballot initiative vote. They always blame the legislature. This is just a fact of life.
Well, you should have known. That'll be the argument.
Yeah. Oh, you have the power to change it. The other side is like, oh, you shouldn't change anything.
Right. Were you surprised at ranked choice voting?
No, I think ranked choice voting actually had a pretty strong vote. But again, it's extremely confusing to people when they see it, because as we talked about last time, it's very unclear if you're forced to vote for people you don't want to vote for. It's discourages or makes it impossible for people to write in candidates. They want to make a serious writing campaign. Writing candidates have won in Massachusetts. You know, it does lead to also a constitutional question, because the Constitution says you have to win by a majority of votes, not the majority of points.
Yep.
And it is that component too. And we actually have avoided seeing an actual usage of that at a federal campaign in Maine when Susan Collins won by just over 50% of the vote. She avoided a ranked choice voting situation. So we actually could have seen a test run of how this would have worked in Maine, and whether or not it would have resulted in a second place finish candidate winning an election, which ranked choice voting does create, that the person with the highest vote total will not win. Because if they tell me, well, it's a consensus vote. So Susan Collins could have lost that election to a second place finish because of the ranked choice voting system. Even though it eliminates the person at the bottom, it shifts the points up. So it is not a majority of voters that approve you. It will be a majority of points that approve you. And I think that was the kind of the misconception of ranked choice voting, because it's a point-based system. So it is actually feasible that could have happened. We would not know if it could have happened, because obviously we didn't get to test out in Susan Collins' race up in Maine. But, you know, it's an interesting statement where you could win or not with a majority of votes.
Think they'll try again?
I don't know. We'll see. The campaign for ranked choice voting was not domestic funded. It was largely funded by outside sources, as the Boston Globe has indicated. So the reality is that even though you can get your signatures done at the local level, the reality is someone's got to back their campaign to help get those signatures and put money to the advertising. I think the Globe says like $9 million-ish, a zone, and with its writing, how much money was put in. So that's, I know people funding this have a lot of money. I'm not going to be naive about that either. I mean, these people have loads of dough. The question is, do they want to put loads of dough here, or are they going to try this again someplace else?
Well, stay tuned for that one as well. We are coming to the end of our chat today, Techie, but I'm guessing that there's no indication as to when you'll be back at the State House.
No, we still don't know yet. The Speaker did touch about that in caucus, and we're still trying to figure it out. Obviously, with COVID increase rising, he has continued to discourage members even from coming to the chamber. We have a right to the chamber, but because of the fact that I know if we look at the demographics of our membership, obviously we have an older generation also as part of our membership, and you know, we're like anybody else. All of us, you know, have different health issues. I mean, no different from any other people. So you know, I won't name certain members because I won't protect their privacy, but I'm aware that some people are cancer survivors. I'm aware that some people are still going to treatments themselves. They are trying to avoid the building. I'm not going to name names, obviously, but I'm aware that there are members and staffers out there that have serious medical issues, but they can still go to work.
Sure.
I think it's no different from any other workplace. So, I mean, once again, be cautious and be helpful to people about that. Going to the next session, my staff and I already talked about how to do public hearing Zoom meetings, public hearings. We do record it like you do, give it to LIS, Information Services, Sales Support on their website, and to do this on Facebook Live. We're now conversing, what if we get like 100 bills to do in a hearing? How are we going to manage sitting like this that long without getting up? At least in a public hearing, I can stand up for a couple of minutes and walk to the side of the room and stretch after sitting for like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And hand the gavel to my co-chair. Because, I mean, people in the audience do the same thing, sitting before me in public hearings. They have to get up and stretch. Unfortunately, in Zoom calls, getting up and stretch is not always easy to do because I have to actually walk off camera, turn off the camera, right. Again, remember, you know, fight over the mute button. I mean, and how do we control time limits on testifying and so forth? So we're trying to sort that out now. Swearing in day is going to be very different. A swearing in day is when we elect the speaker, elect the clerk, Senate elects the Senate president, elects the Senate clerk. And then it's a very special day for first time electeds. You only get one first time swearing in day. So I feel bad for those newly electeds this week, as well as their families, because it's going to be not the same level of energy in the room of welcome and congratulations. I think they may have to limit the number of people in the room, and they probably could do that by limiting to just essential personnel and the newly electeds to be sworn in. We did have a ceremonial ceremony. It takes like 3 hours. After the second time you do this, it does get dull. I won't lie to people. It's about a 3-hour ceremony of special ad hoc committees, of which I've been on, to go to different chambers to announce our opening and have the governor come by, an official opening of all the pomp and ceremony that comes with tradition. A lot of that's not going to be done this year.
Right.
You know, so I don't have an answer of how it's going to work out. This office is still trying to figure out how to deal with this at the speaker's level. My office worked remotely still, and we're still adjusting because we're all having technology challenges at this stage. And people at home don't realize, but we're not compensated for using our equipment. I brought this up to the speaker's office already. The staff is using their own internet, their own electricity, their own equipment that's not designed to be used 12 hours a day. So we receive no reimbursement for that. And we're not being given equipment either yet. So this is a conversation we continue to have with the speaker's office about being provided equipment, and we can't access our servers. Again, security issues.
Sure.
So anything that they have servers, we can't get to. We have to get into Boston and upload it somewhere or put it on a flash drive or something and get documents that way. We do PDF a lot of documents these days to save space on paper.
Sure. And ink, that's very expensive, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, part of new technology takes away a lot of paper electronically, we can't get to our servers. So we do have a lot of, you know, I mean, it's a little different from other people having challenges at home working. We're having the same challenges you are.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. We will continue to forge ahead, though. And I know the phone still works, right? Folks can call you.
Yep, call the office at 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. That's the landline number. Please leave a message with anyone in the office. We'll get it, and we'll get back to you. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. Send me an email. Just please be aware that I get way too much. Your mass health, particularly if you're a senior citizen, you get COVID.
Expected to spend another $1.6 billion next year, this fiscal cycle, on that as a result of delayed elective surgeries, as a result of people qualifying as they get older, the baby boom population continues to get onto mass health programs as they qualify, and COVID impact. And while Medicare, Medicaid programs do get 50% reimbursement from the federal government, it's still a substantial cost to the state. So we are still continuing to face COVID challenges, and that is one of our constituent services I fully expect to get more calls on. So unemployment benefit questions, issues regarding housing, as well as people qualifying for or needing assistance on working through mass health issues. So I think those would be the top three constituent issues I'll be dealing with this fall. I mean, is it fall still?
No.
Coming
fall.
Up, we're still in fall.
It's feeling more like spring right now, but that'll change eventually, I'm sure. And the next time we talk, it'll be Friday the 13th. So.
Yes, it'll be, I may or may not be able to get on the call next week. We'll confirm with you because the budget debate's going to start Tuesday. Obviously, Veterans Day is Wednesday. We'll continue Thursday and told us a whole Friday on standby.
Okay.
Normally start in the afternoon. However, if we start early today, we might have to do a rapid change review staff-wise, but we'll work that out as we get closer.
Okay, sounds good. In the meantime, thanks, Tacky, and be well.
Thank you, Joe, and look forward to see you as always.